Hi, everybody.
Yeah, actually, we can be live.
We're live.
I was going to say that I personally favor skipping the subsequent two topics in the main show and doing a little Ask ATP, but we can.
That's fine. If we get there in time, we can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's. Yeah, that actually makes sense to me. Okay. All right. So, are we ever going to talk about Mythos?
Mythos?
Probably not. What is there to talk about?
Wait, what are we talking about?
The model from Anthropic that is...
Oh, that thing. Yes.
It's
sorry.
So dangerous. Yes. We can't let you have it.
All right. So I'm actually legitimately freaked out about it. I got to say, I was planning a big Overcast server upgrade, and I'm accelerating those plans now. Just only not to like unlock any new functionality, really, just like, you know, I run a certain distribution of Linux that is a few years old now, and it's starting to leave its supported time range for certain patches of certain packages and stuff like that. And I'm on the other side of the big OpenSSL upgrade as well. So I'm like, oh boy, there's no way to really upgrade that in place without breaking everything. So I'm going to, you know, slowly migrate to new servers, but like now I'm like, oh, maybe I should do that a little more quickly than before. I don't know. Are you two really not? You don't think it's going to be a
Mythos
thing?
Mythos is just a marketing BS, but the idea that LLMs can find security flaws is 100% real. And Mythos or not, yeah, you should upgrade your software to versions that you hope have less security flaws in them, because LLMs make it a lot easier for lay people to find those flaws. So. Yeah, I agree with the upgrade process. I just think the whole Mythos thing is a silly, overblown marketing stunt.
Yeah, I think, and again, like I think whether or not Mythos specifically is okay. So just to explain, anybody who missed the story quickly, Anthropic's latest model Mythos, they've only released in a very limited way to like approved people, because what they say is it's incredibly good at finding security vulnerabilities in source code. And it's already found like hundreds of vulnerabilities in old packages, like, you know, like OpenBSD and FFmpeg, like, you know, like old software that's been around forever that's like run on servers and stuff. And so the concern is, if this gets into the mass market, lots of people can find security vulnerabilities and exploit them. And so what they are doing is having like a preview program where they're allowing certain software vendors to have access to it so they can run it against their code, patch their code, and, you know, get those patches released before this is available to the public. Now, this is not a perfect system. You know, Anthropic, as with most AI companies, has a history of overhyping the capabilities of their models and kind of, you know, calling wolf, so to speak, and you know, as
that's a good marketing, right?
It is, and you know, and as Ben Thompson points out, like the story of the boy who cried wolf does end in an actual wolf, but
yeah. Although it's obvious that they didn't run Mythos on their own software, because
yes,
people exploited flaws and a whole Discord got access to Mythos and had it for months.
Right.
So yeah, you're not actually keeping this genie in the bottle. Like, oh, we're only going to release it to a select group of people. That is extremely difficult to do, and they immediately screwed it up by having security flaws in their own software that were exploited by people who just wanted access to it. But setting this aside, like as I discussed, you know, when we were talking about things you can use LLMs for many, many episodes ago, you can just ask it to find bugs in any code, or you could ask it to find security flaws. And it is a tireless searcher for security flaws. You know, it will find things that have not been found by other people, because, you know, it's good at finding them, and it doesn't sleep.
Right. Yeah. So. And one thing I have found with using LLMs to analyze, you know, documents or code or whatever it is like they are often able to find correlations between different sections or different parts that I wouldn't have seen. You know, just because they don't work like human brains, they work differently. And so once you
have, and also because they are tireless, like they're finding bugs in really old code because no human has looked at that code in 20 years. If a human did look at it and concentrated on it, yeah, they would find the same flaws. But no one's looking at that. They're like, oh, that's old, it's debugged, it's fine, it's good. But a computer doesn't have that same, you know, like, oh, I won't look at that code because it's really old and I don't need to bother looking at it. No, you just point it at the whole code base and it just goes through all of it. So it's not like it's even better than humans at it. It is just simply, it does the things that humans don't, which is, I'll look at everything forever as long as you ask me to.
Yeah, and yeah, and I'll never get tired, and I'll never get bored, and I'll never zone out, and I'll never complain that it's really boring. Like,
yeah, and I'll never like skip over stuff because, like, oh, obviously that's fine. I won't do that because I don't know if it's. I just do what you tell me. Here's the code. I'll look at it.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so I think regardless of whether the hype about Mythos is real or valid or earned, like regardless of that, the truth is that we are in a transition point now where, like, in the long run, having LLMs look at a bunch of source code all the time will be great for security because I think fewer security vulnerabilities will get released in the first place because the LLMs will either be writing the code and will avoid them or they will find them.
Well, I don't think they avoid them when they're writing the code. I think they write plenty of themselves because they're copying other code that has security flaws. But yes, you can have a phase where you say, now just keep looking for security flaws until you think you can't find any anymore. And then the new version of the model comes out and you ask it to do the same thing over and over, right?
Right. But in the meantime, like, you know, the transition between having all this sloppy human code that is full of vulnerabilities nobody ever found and the future where LLM code is mostly what's out there or LLM vetted human code or whatever, or LLM assisted human, you know, whatever it is. This transition period, I think it's going to be just a tidal wave of patches coming out from lots of places. And so, like, what I told my family, you know, when this news came out a few weeks ago, I'm like, listen, whenever you get an update on your phone or your devices, just accept it, run it. Like, don't defer software updates for 6 months. But, you know, like, this is a good time to be on the latest versions of everything that you can be on the latest versions of. And, you know, certainly on our personal devices, that's a good idea. You know, I think we can count on the major vendors, you know, Apple, Microsoft. Like, you can count on them to probably issue critical security patches for older OSs back to a point, and Apple has actually done that recently. They've actually issued some very old OS patches recently for like some pretty big bugs. But that's only to a point that they'll do that, and only for like the worst bugs probably. And so this is a really good time. Like the way I think it's wise to deal with whether it's Mythos or Mythos-like things in the present or future is just be running the latest versions of everything you possibly can. And when patches come out, just install them as fast as you can. And this is not a good time to be running old software. And unfortunately, on servers, it's a lot more difficult. You know, and so that's why like I'm embarking on this project to do this giant rolling upgrade, basically. And it's not fun, but I feel like, you know, if Overcast got hacked because I didn't upgrade my Linux version from one from 2024 or whatever, like, I'm going to feel pretty bad about that.
Well, the tricky part of just upgrade to the latest version whenever it comes out is you got to hope those latest versions don't have a bunch of vibe-coded stuff that adds a bunch of horrendous security flaws in it. So, it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword because, yes, and to be clear, you don't need to use Mythos to find security flaws. Any of the existing coding models, they can and will find security flaws, right? Not just Mythos, right? But also, people will use them carelessly to create security flaws because, you know, just because they're good at finding them doesn't mean they won't create them themselves. And because you can create so much code so much faster these days, like I just saw a stat fly by today that GitHub, for all their problems, they're having a bunch of problems related to Microsoft being Microsoft or whatever and absorbing that company. But setting that aside, one stat that they threw out was that the number of commits going into GitHub has increased by a literal order of magnitude since this time last year.
I saw that.
Yeah, that's wild.
So, and where do you think all those new commits are coming from? Did we get 10 times as many programmers in the last year? We did not. So, it's a wild time out there in the software world. You know, and we can use the tools to help protect us, but those same tools are also kind of screwing us over. And there were some, I don't know if any of this is true, but there's a bunch of narrative that part of GitHub's stability problems is because the people at GitHub themselves are vibe coding a bunch of things and it's destroying their stability. But other people say just being bought by Microsoft destroyed their ability because, anyway, I'm not even weighing in on that. But just simply the stat that 10 times more commits are going into, or was it 14 times more commits are happening in GitHub versus a year ago is a fairly large change. It's difficult for GitHub to handle, and it is indicative that more code is being produced than you would expect.
Yeah, but and honestly, like, you know, I don't know what's going on with GitHub, but if I ran a giant web service and it had 14 times the traffic in you know, a few months.
I thought you did that with Tumblr.
Yeah, we grew like 20%, you know, like 20% at a time, basically. Like,
all right, yeah.
This is very different. This is like 14x in, what is it, four months?
They said they're on pace for 14x in a year. If current oh, okay. The current curve continues.
But still, like, that's also, they're starting from a larger scale. So like that's,
oh yeah, they're already pretty,
that's
big.
Significant. Yeah. So like I don't know what the internal politics are there, but I certainly don't blame them for having some uptime issues when they're growing at that rate all of a sudden. that is
well, that's the problem, that if you look at the graph of their stability, the uptime issues happen coincident with the Microsoft acquisition and not coincident with the rise of coding agents. So
yeah,
it's not entirely sure where the cause is there, but I'm sure that story will be told eventually.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a good time to run updated software. So I suggest everyone out there keep those patches installed. Like, install them when they come out. Keep current. This is a bad time to hold on to an old version, as much as macOS Tahoe sucks.
Yeah, unless you're running macOS 15. Because Apple has been patching it, so good on Apple.
Yeah, so far.
All right, let's do some follow-up. I wanted to reiterate, even though the store is closed, it happened yet again. I will save this person's name. I will not share their name to save their dishonor. But an anonymous person wrote in and wrote the following. I thought I would remember, as I always have. I did remember on Monday, the 27th of April, at 1:34 a.m. Pacific time. The store was closed. I wanted to order the RIP Mac Pro shirt to go with my Believe version. RIP me, I guess. Pulling over next time. This is why we say to pull over the car, people. Every time. Every time. Don't be that person next time. Every time.
There was more than one person. I saw at least one other report. It happens, you know? It happens.
It happens. But there is some good news, John. Can you share the good word?
Yeah, the ATP Neo Silver shirt did, in fact, get enough people to order it to have the shirt printed. In the end, a total
really?
Of 34 people bought it. So we had the first week, one person bought it. The second week, two people. And then the third week, everyone came storming in, and they passed that, you know, threshold of a dozen orders. In the end, 34 people ordered it. It will be printed.
What?
Congratulations, ATP Neo Silver shirt owners.
That grew faster than GitHub.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that the most rare piece of ATP merchandise? Because remember that we had those misprints on, I think, the very first run?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think we sold more than 34 of the misprints.
Yeah,
that's
more.
What I'm saying. I think this might be the most rare piece of ATP merchandise.
Nah, we've sold fewer than 34 from other shirts. Normally what happens is the whole thing with the silver is it took so long to go over the threshold. Or we've had things go over the threshold pretty quickly, but still only end up sending like 16 or 20. So I don't think it's that rare.
No, either way. All right. We have a handful of very grumpy people from the University of Pennsylvania who took issue with John. I'm going to say, and this is hyperbolic, poo-pooing their engineering program. I that is, again, hyperbolic. John, would you
it
like
wasn't,
to re-
Yeah, it wasn't poo-pooing their engineering program. It was, I was saying that we were talking about John Ternus last week for a very obvious reason. And I noted that he just had an engineering degree from the University of Pennsylvania. And I was saying how that's a fairly unimpressive pedigree for someone who is the CEO of one of the biggest companies in the world. Just an undergraduate degree, just an engineering degree, and just from University of Pennsylvania. And everyone in the world wrote in to tell us, to remind us that University of Pennsylvania is, in fact, an Ivy League school. I did not remember that at all because Brown fills that slot in my mind as the school that you never remember is an Ivy League school, but really is. We'll put a link in the show notes to Ivy League schools. If you're not in the U.S. and don't know what they are, you can read the Wikipedia page, but it's a bunch of supposedly prestigious schools for reasons that are rooted in history more than anything else. Kieran Healy writes, when I was a grad student, the joke amongst obnoxious Princeton undergraduates about UPenn was that the students there thought the full name of the school was UPenn and Other Ivies. Because to see the people who are there, it's like, would always remind you. And, you know, I go University of Pennsylvania, which is, of course, one of the Ivies. And then Kieran continues, there's also a trollish bit where people deliberately confuse University of Pennsylvania and Penn State, which are two entirely different schools.
Indeed.
And one of them is Ivy League and one of them is not.
Correct.
And then Marina Eppelman writes, arguably, engineering in Penn State is superior to UPenn. That was my other point, that, like, you know, setting aside University of Pennsylvania being an Ivy League school, I don't think it's particularly known as like an amazing engineering school, but to our credit and to Casey's credit, Casey did look up on last episode what it's ranked. And so it's not like we said, oh, this is a terrible school, and then we didn't bother looking into it further. We looked up, you know, Casey looked it up in real time and said on last episode that UPenn is number 16 ranked in engineering, and for whatever U.S. News and World Report is worth. And then BU and Virginia Tech are 32. And what is PSU?
Penn State University.
Penn State is number 28. So yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad school or anything, but my point stands, which is like, he's just got an engineering bachelor's degree. The other point that I should have made, he doesn't even have an MBA. Like, if you're going to be like an executive, very often you'll get like an engineering degree, but eventually you decide like, actually, I want to be like a C-level executive or something. And so you get an MBA on top of your undergrad, or you'll get an undergrad and a master's and an MBA. Like,
can I just say,
unless you're a founder of a company, you tend not to see someone going to the C-level of a company without more degrees. That was my only point. And I said, you know, it shows that you don't need to worry about getting a bunch of fancy degrees from fancy schools to become a CEO. But obviously, UPenn being an Ivy League kind of undercuts that a bit. But still, just having a bachelor's degree and not being a founder of a company, pretty good job. And then other people argued, well, he did that a long time ago, and things have changed, and now you actually do need the degree. And I'm not sure that's the case, but all I'm saying is, don't let your education dictate your destiny.
Also, thank God the new CEO of Apple doesn't have an MBA.
I mean, it's rare. Like, obviously, Apple's a special case, but look at the CEOs of most other companies. You will see that like they're either like business people or have business degrees or have some other degree of whatever they're interested into, and then they got an MBA, because that's kind of how you get into the, like, I want to be, you know, management in the C-level eventually. You get an MBA and you tack it on to whatever your other degree was.
All right. We have a kind of Mark Gurman corner. First of all, Gurman reported on Tim Cook's remarks to Apple employees regarding his pending retirement or I don't know, reassignment.
Not retirement, but stepping down as CEO.
There you
stepping
go.
Up to be executive chairman. I don't know. He's stepping somewhere.
Stepping onto the roof. So he spoke to Apple employees on Tuesday, the 21st of April. A couple of quotes that Gurman reports. I'm excited to continue my journey at Apple as executive chairman. I am healthy, my energy is high, and I plan to be in this new role for a long time.
That addresses the point we talked about last time when I asked, how long do you think Tim Cook will be executive chairman at Apple? And I said, I don't think he'll ever leave. And so what he's saying is, first of all, I'm healthy, which is his way of saying, I'm not stepping down as CEO because I'm about to die, right? Like, there's not some health thing. You know, I'm healthy, my energy is high, and guess what? I plan to be here for a long time. I'm not just being executive chairman in the next year. I'm going to retire and go fishing. That's not his plan currently. So all this checks out. It's going to be tough to get rid of Tim Cook if he's healthy, exercising, and does not really ever feel like leaving as executive chairman.
Tim continues, here to support John in any way he needs and in any way I can. I'll be here to offer my knowledge and experience and be a sounding board anytime I'm called upon. Apple will be my top priority. It's who I am at my core. That's a good Apple joke. And I can't imagine it any other way.
Again, that's an Apple lifer talking right there.
Mm-hmm. Cook finalized, there can only be one CEO at a time, which is a good way of saying I'm not going to be in the way, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, certainly executive chairman of the board should be a much easier, more relaxing job for Tim than being CEO, obviously. And so congratulations to him to hopefully lowering his stress levels.
Then with regard to Mark Ternus, wow, let me try that again.
Wow.
Mark Gurman with regard to John Ternus, there we go. Gurman writes, Ternus was a champion of the MacBook Neo. He urged the company to sell a cheaper laptop that could appeal to a younger generation. Longtime colleagues described Ternus as someone willing to make clear calls, in contrast to Cook's more deliberative, consensus-oriented approach. Quote, Ternus will make decisions, quote, when it comes to product development, said one person who's worked closely with both executives. Quote, if you go into Tim with A or B, he won't pick. He'll ask a series of questions instead if he has concerns. Ternus, on the other hand, will choose, said the person. It could be right or wrong, but at least it's a decision. That shift could mark the end of an era in which major product decisions were made collectively by a small group of top executives. Ternus is expected to take a more centralized approach where he will be a singular decision maker. Earlier this month, Ternus overhauled the hardware engineering organization around what he calls a new AI platform designed to speed up product development and improve device quality. It's indicative of his plan to deploy AI quickly throughout the company to improve its operations. The executive has told staffers that he will remain closely involved with hardware engineering efforts aiming to shepherd the next generation of technologies.
So this characterization of Ternus as decisive in areas where Cook wasn't sounds encouraging, but I do have to say that I've also seen reports of the exact opposite, that he's not decisive and is afraid to make decisions. So it's really hard to tell what's going on inside there. That's like, the problem I've always cited when talking about this is Turnus, as he existed in the company run by Tim Cook, necessarily was subsumed under the way Tim Cook wanted to do things. So it's very difficult to figure out how he in particular does things, except for through like these anonymous reports from people in Turnus's reporting chain who can describe what he was like. And that's, you know, that's presumably what this is. But what will he be like as CEO? I can tell you, I would love him to be decisive, even if he makes mistakes. You know, again, he's supposedly a proponent of the touch bar, which I don't think was a good idea. But decisively backing the touch bar might have had a different result than throwing the touch bar out there and letting it languish until you just give up on it and never make any changes to it. So, like, I'm all for decisive action, especially if that decisive action can go in the opposite direction, which is we take decisive action, we try it, and then we decisively figure out that we screwed up and decisively stop, right? As opposed to just kind of going, I don't know, maybe try this, see how it goes, whatever. So I'm kind of hearing what I want to hear in these stories, but until proven otherwise, I'm continued to be optimistic about how things will go.
Yeah, this honestly sounds, you know, it having Turnus come in here with a different style and everything, we don't know for sure this is going to be a good thing. Time will tell, but I'm pretty optimistic. I think this is what Apple needs. Obviously, any strategy can go wrong, but whenever we've heard stories about Tim Cook's leadership style as CEO, there's a few themes that run through. Number one is basically what Gurman says here of, like, Cook does not like to be brought problems. I've even heard people say, like, don't bring me problems. It's one of his things that he has always said. It seems like, you know, Cook does a really good job of seeming like a nice, calm, chill guy, you know, in public or in interviews. But everything we've heard about Cook's leadership style sounds a lot less nice and chill. It sounds like Cook is ruthless and leads by sheer force of will in a what are you doing asking me this question kind of way. That's the story, the kind of theme of what we hear is that's more what he is, a ruthless bean counter and decision avoider, and very cold. Like all the descriptions of Cook in this leader's side, it's like a cold, ruthless numbers guy. Nothing we've heard about Turnus sounds anything like that. And that's why I'm optimistic. Like, it's not that, you know, it's not that Cook is without benefit to the company. Obviously, you know, he did very well in lots of ways. But, like, I think the way to get great products more consistently is more the kind of style we're hearing about Turnus, not the kind of style we've heard about Cook.
Yeah, and like I think one of the aspects that doesn't get talked about much these days is the ability to inspire the organization behind whatever it is that you think is your vision or whatever. And for all Tim Cook's, you know, good sides, I don't feel like he was ever an inspiration to the people who reported to him or to parts of the organization in terms of a vision of where we're going. Whereas I have no friggin' idea how Turnus actually was within the company under Tim Cook, but it seems like the hardware division did a good job in a way that I can only imagine happening if Turnus was inspiring them to do their best work. Maybe that's not true. I don't know. But like when you have an organization excelling, you always imagine that the leadership is not just like making the right decisions and getting people to do things on the right track, but they're also inspiring those people to go the extra mile, to be enthusiastic about something cool that they're doing. And it's hard to imagine Apple's recent hardware run without there being some kind of inspiration in that organization. Because it's not just like, oh, we're afraid of the boss and we'll just try to do a really good job. And it's not just like, oh, we're really smart. Because there's tons of really smart people at Apple. And there's tons of people who want to do a good job. But having leadership that inspires, and that's one thing Steve Jobs did. He had enthusiasm for certain things. And if the thing he was enthusiastic about, he would inspire people to do it. Obviously, Steve Jobs was enthusiastic about what he considered to be good user interface design. Very often he had weird ideas, but it's so clear that the people who were also inspired by, were on the same wavelength as him, were like, yeah, I do want to make the best looking button that you want to lick. Was that a good idea? But I can tell you, he sure as hell inspired that team to make Aqua to his taste, and that team was enthusiastic to do it because they could see the vision. Like, yes, we're going to do this. Again, you can quibble with the ideas, but it was so clearly not just like, this is what we're going to do and everyone get in line. How could you not help but be inspired by Steve Jobs' obvious enthusiasm for what would become the Aqua interface. And, you know, and so that's what I hope Turnus will provide that Cook didn't, which is whatever Turnus is excited about, whether it's the touch bar or cheap laptops or whatever things that he's excited about, I want him to inspire the Apple organization to get behind his vision, because they want them to see that he's super jazzed and into it. And like, what the hell was Tim Cook super jazzed and into, you know, product wise? I guess
nothing.
Maybe the car, and maybe also like the iPad for a while, but it was so hard to tell.
I don't know if Cook was super jazzed about anything. Like, that's just not his style.
Super jazzed about earnings calls, I guess.
Even, yeah, I mean, he, but like, but that's, I think also, you know, kind of another aspect of these styles is, you know, one of the things we've always heard about Cook is, again, like the don't bring me problems. What that meant is that it kind of pushed problems down in the organization. The idea, I believe, I think the goal of a you know, philosophy like that is to make the people under you figure things out and deal with things themselves and deal with conflict, resolve conflicts themselves. Don't bring it to you. That's kind of the idea. But one of the downsides of that approach is that many problems in the organization can result, or many problems in the products can result from like weird personality problems, like in like some mid-level of leadership. And so if like some VP doesn't get along with some other VP, or there's friction between two different divisions or whatever, like that can cause, that can like hold back a product, or that can cause certain dysfunctions, or that can, you know, create the wrong incentives. And ideally, the leader, through both inspiration, as John was just saying, and I think through being a little more involved in product development in a company like Apple, should ideally bring those conflicts better to resolutions that are directed from the philosophy at the top, rather than Cook saying, figure it out yourself, don't come to me with your BS. That just pushes down, that's like, you know, that's like, you know, deal with your problems by suppressing them. Like, that doesn't really work. And we've heard over the years, we've heard so many stories of like, why is this thing this way? Oh, it's because this one leader of this one group like refuses to do it any other way, and there's some conflict between them and some other group. Like, we've heard these stories, enough of them that it's there's probably some truth to this general dynamic. So the Turnus style, if it's more like the Jobs style, you know, Jobs would get in there and like, you know, command things to happen, and they would happen. And, you know, it's a harder process to scale. Like, the job style is harder to scale as a company gets really big. But that does result in certain frictions being removed. Now, it also bottlenecks certain things. If more things are going through the CEO, you do have to, you know, deal with bottlenecks here and there. But like,
yeah, like Apple under the Jobs 2 era, you could kind of tell what they were concentrating on. And other things suffered during that time because of that bottleneck.
Right. And so, you know, there are, you know, the approaches are not without their downsides, but I think the Jobs approach, and what it sounds like hopefully the Turnus approach is closer to, I think that's better for Apple's product quality overall. You know, we can argue about finances and operations and everything, and there's, you know, there's ways to delegate those things. You know, you don't have to, the CEO is not the one going to every factory or whatever. You know, you can delegate, but the general leadership style of Jobs and allegedly Turnus sounds better for Apple and for Apple's products.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm really hopeful that once things get settled, we're going to see kind of a new normal that's maybe better, which would be really nice.
Also, can I mean, this is just pure speculation here. Do you think it's worth noting that we have a chief hardware officer now? But Craig Federighi did not get elevated to chief software officer.
I mean, he wasn't the one who was threatening to leave.
Right,
and
but
he's
like,
not as indispensable as Sarucci. So that's what that boils down to.
Yeah, like I mean, look, I don't want to start any crap or anything, but like that to me kind of stood out as like, maybe Federighi's not going to be with us that much longer in this role.
I mean, that's up to him, right? Like, that's another thing that I haven't seen mentioned as much. It got mentioned a couple times in the CEO transition, but like, and we've been talking about it for months leading up to this. Like, oh, you know, when there's a CEO transition, obviously there's a lot of turnover because like now's the time to re-examine what you're doing, and maybe you're old as well, blah, blah, blah. But that turnover does not necessarily end when the CEO transition is announced. So don't be surprised if you see more executive turnover surrounding the CEO transition, not just only before it. So I agree with you. Like, if, I don't think Federighi is going anywhere, but like, don't be shocked if you see some more people leave. And it's like, well, why didn't they leave before the transition? Surely they knew it was coming. It's like, sometimes it happens before, sometimes it happens after. But I mean, just the Federighi situation, him not becoming chief software officer or whatever, from an outside perspective, because I have no idea what's going on in there, Apple's hardware is amazing. Apple's chips are amazing. Apple's software is less amazing. I mean, is it as simple as that? The hardware guy becomes CEO, the chip guy becomes chief hardware officer, and the software guy, you stay where you are. You got some work to do.
Well, and I think, like, you know, if we maybe, you know, whenever Federighi does actually retire or leave, I'm sure we'll do a whole thing about, like, what we feel about his era. But I do think the Federighi era has been defined by some things being pretty good and some things being a little rough.
And also, I have to say, I mean, this is one of the things that I would say in the defense of Federighi is, at various times, including currently, he hasn't actually been in charge of all software to the detriment of, like, I mean, so the, for example, Siri has been passed around like a hot potato, not spending too much time under Federighi. How can he be expected to,
I'd
like,
say it's
oh,
been
well,
passed around more like nuclear waste.
Right. But, like, and I believe Siri was under Federighi for some period of time, but for a thing, for, like, long-suffering weaknesses in Apple software platform, Federighi, if you had given that to Federighi 10 years ago and it had always been his, I think it would have done better than if it had been passed around the org and you had hired the Google guy from the outside and let him run it and then given it to Rockwell, and like, it's been all over the place. And like, I just feel like it's unfair to say, well, Federighi, you're the highest level software guy, so anything involving software with Apple is your fault. Some things are, but not everything, and in particular not Siri, which has been one of the most glaring weaknesses that has only become more glaring with the advent of LLM. So I give Federighi some cover for, like, I mean, Tsurugi has been in charge of Apple Silicon, right? There's no, it hasn't been passed around. It hasn't been divided up between him and some outside hires and stuff. It's just him. So it lives or dies based on him. But Federighi has been gaining responsibility, but at various times has not been given responsibility over all the things. So I don't know.
Yeah, I would also say eventually. I would also say, like the Federighi era, like some of its, I think some of its shortcomings are around like product or design decisions about the software that he probably was not the one making those decisions, or at least not exclusively.
Yeah, he's involved in that process, but he is not the head of design.
Right. And, like, you know, I think my, like, if you look at, like, the challenges of the Federighi software era, even let's leave out Siri, because, yeah, we know that's been nuclear waste, but, like, leave out Siri for now. I think the main challenges of the Federighi era have been, you know, software design, which isn't really him, software quality, which is him, and, you know, that's we can talk about. And I would say the features that are developed with Federighi, there's immense engineering sophistication and an immense care for privacy and, like, just really great engineering behind a lot of these features. But then you have the user-facing features are, like, really kind of, like, finicky and complicated configuration stuff, like focus modes and, like, the home screen configuration stuff, and, like, there's a lot of stuff there that's, like, I see where this came from, but it is delivered as a very kind of complicated story that I think could have used better product direction. So, like, and again, I don't know the way things work between software design and marketing and, like, how the product decisions are made. I don't know how much of that was Federighi's call, but the software quality is under him for sure. And I do think, like, regardless of whatever other inputs there are on design and product decisions, software quality itself is 100% on Federighi's leadership and his organization. Like, that is definitely him. And I do think that story with software has been spotty. You know, it's and I like Federighi, like, as a leader, as a presenter, as a character. and I like that he, you know, I've had the chance to meet him a few times, and he is very clearly a very good engineer. And he, like, the technical sophistication of the things that he, for, you know, both understands and has implemented in the past and has led the implementation of more recently, like, he really knows his stuff at a technical engineering level. And everything they say about, like, privacy and everything, he embodies that. He values that. He enforces that. So I give him 100% credit for being a real nerd's nerd, a really good engineer, and having the right principles about things like quality and privacy. But the quality part is – the execution on the quality part has been spotty. But I do wonder, like, with this new elevation of Turnus – we don't know how Turnus and Federighi get along. Probably – I'm sure that's fine. But, like, with that elevation, Federighi – I don't think Federighi wanted to be CEO. So I don't think there's that kind of weird friction. But, like, that's got to maybe, like, put an end date in his mind of when he wants to leave. And I it would not surprise me – if the Federighi era ends sooner than people think. I would be shocked if he's still there in, say, certainly 5 years, maybe even 3 years. And then finally, my one really crazy wild card, which I know this is ridiculous, but what if they brought Scott Forstall back?
Oh my word.
They won't. I mean, this is not a serious.
I don't think he wants to come back.
Correct.
And honestly, I don't want him to come back. But but you know, like, that's the type of thing that a new CEO can make happen. Because honestly, as much as Tim Cook was responsible for Forstall being booted out or leaving or whatever, Tim Cook wouldn't stop Turnus from bringing Forstall back if he wanted. It doesn't seem like a thing that is going to happen. And I think I don't agree with a lot of things that Forstall did, but. To give an example, Forstall definitely inspired the people under him. And the same way, I feel like Federighi's obvious enthusiasm for the technical aspects of his work inspires the people who work under him, who are also enthusiastic about those things. So there's a positive effect of the positive effect of enthusiasm is what I'm endorsing in this episode. That, like, if you're excited about a job-related thing, you can't be excited about every job-related thing. But Federighi, when we see him speak, he's clearly animated, enthusiastic about specific aspects of his work. And it's infectious. Right. If you are also on that same wavelength, like, yes, my boss's boss's boss is also super into this thing that I also think is cool, and we're going to do some awesome stuff together. And they do. And then there's the parts that he seems less enthusiastic about or has bad taste with. Right. So, you know, nobody's perfect. But yeah, Forstall coming back. Turnus could do that if he felt like it was the right thing to do. And Forstall was willing to do it, which it seems like Forstall's happy out there doing whatever he wants. But
yeah. I mean,
you know,
to be clear,
stranger, like, things have happened.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, like, I don't think that's a realistic outcome for lots of reasons. But it is an interesting thing, I think, to think about as fans, just like a wild fantasy to think about.
Especially if Federighi leaves and there's a gap and it's like, who can we get to fill this gap? It's like, well, we have one guy who kind of has already been in that seat. And if he suddenly has a change of heart and is like, you know what? Yeah, you know, there's a gap, there's a power vacuum, and you're going to bring me back. Hey, it worked for Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think about an hour ago we were in follow-up, so let's continue. The ability to be hotter. What was the context for this, please, John?
This is
Mac Studio Thermals,
right? Apple making computers that can cool CPUs that have more transistors and that dissipate more energy in exchange for doing more computation. They're, you know, as of now, their biggest computer is the Mac Studio. It can only dissipate, you know, under 300 watts of power, or it is only dissipating under 300 watts of power with the current most power-hungry chip. What if you could dissipate twice that heat? Could you put a chip that had twice as many transistors and was maybe 1.5 times as fast? I think you could, but Apple hasn't done it. So on that topic of the ability for Macs to be hotter in exchange for doing more computation.
Yeah, so Rachel Neuer in Scientific American writes, as reported in Science, a metallic material called theta phase tantalum nitride.
Tantalum.
That too. Tantalum nitride achieved a thermal conductivity of about 1,110 watts per meter Kelvin, about three times higher than copper's 400 watts per meter Kelvin. And it works in a way scientists have never seen before. Quote, our result breaks the historic ceiling for heat transport metallic materials, says senior author Yongji Hu, physicist and engineer at the University of California, Los Angeles. Given this conductor's superior performance, it has the potential to complement or even replace copper.
So Apple, even if you want to keep the Mac Studio the same size, boy, do I have a way you could get more heat out of it. Maybe three times as much heat. I don't know how much this Alloy costs or how difficult it is to manufacture, but it's probably actually much more relevant for things like phones, where a tiny amount of this exotic material could dissipate heat even better. But I'm excited about material advances. So Apple, just make a bigger Mac case to dissipate more heat. But on the phones, put one of these suckers in there because it sounds cool.
Yeah, it literally sounds cool, John. You're
yeah.
Exactly right.
Wow.
All right. Hello, Future Marco. I personally vote we just kill it here, yeah, but I'm happy to keep going.
No, but we can go right to topics.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right.
Because we've gotten a big one here. I will close this sucker up.
Cool. You good, John?
Yep.
All right, good deal. All right, let's do some topics. And we've had, this is one of those topics that we've had on the docket for a couple of weeks, but we just haven't had a chance to talk about it. We're going to talk about Backblaze and how they're no longer backing up everything that we thought they were. Before I go any further, I wanted to remind everyone, Backblaze is a former sponsor. They are not currently a future sponsor. In fact, they last sponsored us, I believe, the summer of 2023, as far as my records indicated, but I just want to make that plain for everyone. With that in mind, Robert Anton Reese wrote sometime semi-recently, despite claiming to back up all of your data, Backblaze quietly stopped backing up OneDrive and Dropbox folders, along with potentially many other things. And later in the same piece, which we'll link in the show notes, of course, he said the following, which I thought was very... At first, I thought it was a bit dramatic. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, no, actually, I think he's onto something here. Anyway, Robert Anton Reese wrote, by deciding not to back up everything, Backblaze has made it as if they are backing up nothing. His point here is that if it always used to be that you could just assume that Backblaze was backing up everything. And over the years, they seem to be chipping away at that in bits and pieces and fits and spurts. And so now there's some amount of question. Are they backing up X? Are they backing up Y? Are they backing up Z? And at that point, it's like, well, what am I even doing here in the first place? Now, to be fair, I am a Backblaze person. I still like it. I still use it. I am unaware of a better solution for my needs. We're going to talk about other options toward the end of this topic, but that's where I stand. And maybe once you guys start chiming in, you can tell me your situation. But one way or another, John, it looks like you did some spelunking and discovered in Mac version 9.2.2.878, which was released roundabouts of the end of August 2025. There's the following in the release notes. Recent macOS versions can mount cloud storage, for example, Google Drive, OneDrive, and Dropbox, in local paths, causing the backup client to mistakenly back them up. These cloud-mounted folders are now detected and excluded to avoid performance issues, excessive data usage, and restore complications. Meanwhile, in version 9.2.2.877, and this is for Windows now, the backup client now excludes popular cloud storage providers from backup, including both mount points and cache directories. This prevents performance issues, excessive data usage, and unintended uploads from services like OneDrive, Google Drive, Dropbox, Box, iDrive, and others. This change aligns with Backblaze's policy to backup only local and directly connected storage. People were not happy about this, and people got very unhappy about this in a lot of places, including on Backblaze's Reddit, or subreddit, excuse me.
And by the way, just to reiterate the date for those versions that I just pulled out here, and I was guessing based on like archive.org pages and some random web page I found that listed the date as being around end of August, early September 2025, because Backblaze does not put dates in their own release notes on their website. That's why I had to do the spelunking to figure it out. Anyway, that's summer 2025. When these releases came out that started excluding these things. So it's taken people, to Casey's earlier point, it's taken people like almost a year to go, hey, wait a second. You mean it's not backing up my stuff in my Dropbox? And that's one of the worst things about this is like, you just assume it's doing a thing and backing up your stuff. And if you don't have occasion to check, you know, maybe you won't know that suddenly a thing that was being previously backed up is not being backed up. So yes, people have discovered it almost a year later and are making lots of noise about it, which is why it's in the news now.
Right. So on their subreddit, Natasha, who is an employee at Backblaze, wrote the following. This decision was driven by a consistent set of technical issues we were seeing at scale, most of them driven by updates created by third-party sync tools, including unreliable backups and incomplete restores when backing up files managed by third-party sync providers. These cloud storage providers now rely heavily on OS-level frameworks to manage sync state. On Windows, for example, files are often represented as reparse points, which is an NTFS thing, via the Cloud Files API. When they can appear local, they are still system-managed placeholders, which makes it difficult to reliably back them up as standard on-disk files. Additionally, Jim, another Backblaze employee, chimed in. Once a reparse point is added, Backblaze is unable to back up the file even if it physically resides on the computer. Not great, Bob. Continuing from Natasha, we built our product in a way to not back up reparse points for two reasons. One, we wanted the backup client to be light on the system and only back up needed user-generated files. Two, we wanted the service to be unlimited, so following reparse points would lead us to backing up tons of data in the cloud. We've made targeted investments where we can, for example, adding support for iCloud Drive by working within Apple's model and supporting Google Drive. But extending that same level of support to third-party providers like Dropbox or OneDrive is more complex and not included in the current version. We are currently exploring an add-on that either follows reparse points or backs up the tag data in another way. We also hear you clearly about the communication gap. Both the sync providers and Backblaze should have been more proactive in notifying customers about a change with this level of impact. Please feel free to reach out to me directly if you have any questions. So here's the thing. I've read into this some, and I think two things are simultaneously true. It seems to me that by way of the OS level affordances for this stuff becoming more of a thing and arguably somewhat more opaque for anything that isn't like Dropbox itself or, you know, whatever your provider is itself, it does legitimately make it harder for Backblaze to the point that it seemed so unreliable, if you are to believe Backblaze, so unreliable that it's almost worse for them to try to back this stuff up, because then some parts will get there, some files won't get there, some files will be in a weird state, and it's inconsistent, and that's arguably worse. It's better off to just say, screw it, we're not going to back any of this stuff up. I genuinely have no reason to believe, maybe John will correct me here in a minute, but I have no reason to believe that's untrue. However, to just kind of quietly slide this into release notes and not say anything about it, and also to say that it's on the sync providers, let me reread what Natasha said. We also hear you clearly on the communication gap. Both the sync providers and Backblaze should have been more proactive in notifying customers. I don't think this is on Dropbox or whatever or whoever else to notify Backblaze customers that this is the case. This is a Backblaze problem.
Well, I mean, so it's, I see what they're saying in that. You remember when Dropbox went to rolled out their file provider version, one that works with Apple's framework for doing cloud files as opposed to using like the custom system that Dropbox did? When they rolled that out, Dropbox, first of all, it was optional or opt-in, and like within the little Dropbox app on macOS, it would be like, you know, there was a thing you could click. It could be like, what is this? What are you talking about, file provider? Which would lead you to a webpage on Dropbox.com, which would say, hey, here's the deal with the file provider version. We're doing this because Apple's making us, they basically said, which was true because Apple's trying to make them use their framework. And if you go to this version, here are the limitations. And those limitations were like, other programs that were previously accessing files in your Dropbox might have problems because of the way file provider works. And so I feel like Dropbox actually did do a better job of saying, if you choose to go to the file provider version of Dropbox, it won't work the same as the old one in ways that affect other apps. Like, we are changing the way our stuff in Dropbox looks to the rest of the system, and that will have an effect on those other apps. And I think that's what Backblaze is getting at in terms of, like, you know, they would like, because like Backblaze didn't decide to make Dropbox files harder to back up. Dropbox decided to do that. And Dropbox, I feel like, did communicate that to the best of their ability, much better than Backblaze communicated it, that's for sure. Because I know that when this happened to Dropbox, and Dropbox made it opt in. In fact, I still have not opted into file provider on Dropbox. I'm still right now running the non-file provider version of Dropbox because it's better. Because they're just regular files, and they are backed up by Backblaze and all that. Backblaze probably excluding it by path or whatever, but like they could in theory be backed up by Backblaze, so they're just plain files. It's not using file provider at all. So that's the other half of that. But I get what you're saying, and it's like, well, in the end, you're the backup provider. Regardless of the reason it is that you can no longer back up these files, that's on you to communicate. Like, so if Dropbox says, hey, we might affect other apps because we're changing the way we're doing things and Apple's making us. And then the other people who are affected have to say, hey, Dropbox just released a new version. If you're using the file provider version, our backup app can no longer back up your files, so seek an alternative method. And they just didn't say anything. Like, they put it in their release notes, you know, in a door in a basement behind a sign that says, beware of tiger. And they did it a year ago in the summer, and then didn't say anything. And by the way, I would like to return to what they said in their release notes. It says, like, recent versions of macOS can mount cloud storage, which is a weird way of describing it in local paths, causing the backup client to mistakenly back them up. These cloud-mounted folders are now detected and excluded to avoid performance issues, excessive data usage, and restore complications. Restore complications is the only one that is later referenced. No one references performance issues or excessive data. Excessive data usage is like, that's what we're paying you for, to take our excessive data. Like, the whole
using Backblaze is excessive data usage.
Exactly. It's like, oh, if we backed up those files, we would have more files in the backup. Yeah, that's the whole thing. We watched. So their release notes characterize it as like, oh, this is a bug. We shouldn't have ever been backing up those files anyway, and we're doing it because there are performance issues and blah, blah, blah. Restore complications is the only legit one, because it's like, if we can't back them up and you go to restore them and we have like half of the files, then you're going to be mad about that, so we're just excluding the whole thing. So their release notes, which are, you know, release notes are not the official communication mechanism for a nuanced discussion of this thing. It's like a paragraph. But the release notes, compare the release notes to what Natasha says on Reddit. Totally different reasoning. Now all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, here's why we're doing it, and we can't back them up and restore things and blah, blah, blah. It's like they weren't speaking with one voice in this, and they were definitely not trying to advertise the fact that they were doing it, which is like, that's the communication gap. And that is the biggest, easiest slam dunk against Backblaze, is like, you failed to communicate this to your customers, and it's an important thing that your customers needed to know. And so now they're doing damage control. But for the technical aspects of it, having dealt with cloud files in hyperspace, I have some experience yes. with this. I get where they're coming from, because like in hyperspace, I've got it easy. And even though I had it easy, recall that version 1.0 wouldn't touch cloud files at all, because I knew there were going to be complications, and I'm like, it's a 1.0, let's not overcomplicate it. But when I did tackle cloud files in whatever version that was, 1.3 or whatever, I have it easy, because given the APIs in macOS, I can tell when a file is cloud synced, and I can tell when, like, all right, you know, there's APIs where I can say, hey, is this file cloud synced or not? And the OS will tell me yes or no. Most of the time it's right, although sometimes it's not. and then I can also say, all right, so if it is cloud synced, is the file actually on this disk, or is this just like, you know, a stub for the file? And if I were to read it, I would get the file contents, but it's not actually here. And if it tells me, oh, that's just like a stub, that the file isn't there, I don't have to touch it because my app saves disk space. And if the file's not there, I'm done. Hey, it's not even there, right? Because, like, what the hell am I, you know, I'm not going to force the file to be downloaded so I can see if I can dedupe it. It saves the most space by not being on the disk. So that's I have it easy. And even doing that, there are lots of nuances and blah, 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 right? But a backup client can't do that. A backup client can ask those questions. And if the answer is, yeah, that file's not even on the disk, the backup client now has a difficult choice. It's like, well, I could skip it and be like, well, how am I going to back up a file that's not on the disk? Or I could cause it to be downloaded, which takes disk space. And also, by the way, I can tell you that asking macOS's file provider thing to cause a non-downloaded file to be downloaded, you might as well put a letter in the mail. Like, it's like on iOS, where you make a suggestion about a thing that might happen in the future, and then you go away for a month and come back and see if it's happened. It's not as if, you can sit there with your arms crossed and being like, so is the file going to be downloaded? Is it going to happen? It's like, well, there's a whole other daemon that does that, and it's busy right now, and it's a low priority thread, and you're like tapping your fingers, and it's like, okay, and how many of those can you wait on at the same time? And then how long do your backups take? And then what if hours pass and that one file doesn't download? Is there a big button you can push to make that one file downloaded? Hell no. Otherwise, there'd be that button in Photos too, where you could say, just download the photos right now. Sync now. You don't do low priority threads. Do everything. There's no do it now. Like, you're at the mercy of the system. And so if you're a backup app, you're like, I can't tell you that I will successfully ever reliably get all these files to the point where they download. And by the way, what you'd want to do is get them to download, back them with the backblaze, but then evict them again, because you don't want to take up the disk space. The whole point is, like, the cloud storage, it's like, oh, they're not even all on your disk. Maybe they don't even all fit on your disk. So you can't ask them all to be downloaded, because you'll fill the disk. So you got to ask a small number to be downloaded, then wait for them to be downloaded, then upload them, then re-evict them. Oh, by the way, what if they were editing the file during that hour-long process? I understand why a backup client is going to be like, we just can't, like, even if we tried to do this, we will not be able to give you a coherent, internally consistent backup of this, because they can't even use things like APFS snapshots, right? Because you snapshot a directory filled with a bunch of stub files, that doesn't, like, you have a point in time image of a directory with half the files that aren't there, right? If the files were all there, you could snapshot it and then read the snapshot and backup like Time Machine does. But if they're stub files that are in cloud storage, what the hell are you going to do? You can't cause them to be downloaded into the snapshot. So I am totally on board with Backblaze saying, we can't actually back up these files in a reliable fashion. I know everyone in all the threads is like, but what if they're all downloaded? Backblaze can't know that they're all downloaded. Do you want it to iterate over the whole thing, confirm that they're all downloaded, then start backing them up? Guess what? In between the time that it confirmed they're all downloaded and started backing them up, some of them got evicted. Now what do you do? Like, there's no 100% solution to this. And it's just the nature of the pros of the system is, oh, so you can have a Dropbox that's 4 terabytes, and you can mount that on your 1 terabyte Mac. How does that work? Well, half the files aren't there. They're just stubs. And it's all transparent to you. And if you just double-click them, they all work as long as your internet connected and blah, blah. Like, that's the benefit. The downside is you can't back it up in a reasonable manner. It's just not possible. So I think this is a case where Backblaze did a really poor job communicating a real technical issue. And they continued, by the way, I think, to do a really poor job of communicating both the technical issue and what they're going to do about it. But I do think they're not just like, oh, they're just being lazy and trying to save money. Like, I don't actually think there's an easy way for them to do this successfully. And as they noted, like, we're looking into this, that, and the other thing, and we've worked with Apple directly to do iCloud Drive backups. Like, how are they doing iCloud Drive backups? Well, if you can work directly with Apple, they can figure something out. Like, I'm sure this has taken a long time where, you know, they're talking to Apple. Apple does actually control the, you know, whatever it is, the, I forget what it's called, Cloud D or the ubiquitous storage backend. Like, there's demons on macOS that do this. Apple writes those, right? And so they can work something out with Backblaze. Here's how you can actually back up iCloud files in a somewhat safe and consistent manner. But I bet even there are situations in which a particular Backblaze run will fail to back up a file because it couldn't get the stupid cloud demon to download the thing locally. But whatever, they're doing that, and the same thing with Google Drive, but Dropbox is a little bit more exotic than, say, OneDrive. And then on Windows, I have no freaking idea what a reparse point is, and I don't even want to know. But apparently there are additional complications that I do not understand there, so I can't chime in on what that situation is. But yeah, I'm kind of in the same situation as Casey. Again, Backblaze has been a past sponsor. I would gladly have them as a future sponsor because I think Backblaze is the best cloud-based backup product for the Mac. It's just that in this world we live in, the number of limitations on that product are just increasing with the use of the file provider and various cloud storage things. There are other alternatives that we'll talk about in a little bit, but I still use and pay for Backblaze, and I think it is the best software that does what it does. But I think they did a terrible job communicating this limitation. And, you know, like any backup strategy, you got to have multiple ones, right? So even if Backblaze is totally ignoring my Dropbox, I have other things that are like my Super Duper clone that are not ignoring Dropbox because Super Duper doesn't care about Dropbox. And because I don't use the file provider version of Dropbox, all my Dropbox files are plain normal files on my disk, and Super Duper backs them up fine. And by the way, so does Time Machine. So, you know, backing up is difficult, and the price of good backups is eternal vigilance. And in this case, our vigilance was somewhat thwarted. Our vigilance was thwarted by Backblaze doing a really bad job of communicating this change.
Yep, no argument. We'll put a couple other links in the show notes. There's a blog post from Backblaze that's kind of, we're victims too, which, again, like, I think there's truth to that, but I just don't love the way in which it was communicated. There's also some other reports and roundup from MJ Tsai, as always. And then there's some alternatives here that we can at least have you look at. I don't know if we necessarily recommend them, but we can point you in their directions.
Yeah, this first one is not a piece of software, but it is a strategy that I saw mentioned many, many times, and I do want to address it because it can work, but only in certain circumstances. So here's the suggestion. Number one, if you're a Dropbox user, don't use the file provider version of Dropbox. That there's an option for that buried in the app. You can even opt out of it once you've opted back in. It's the same piece of software. For a while, I thought it was like a different version, but like right now, it's like the same. It's just the Dropbox client for the Mac, and the same piece of software can run in two different modes, apparently. If you can find your way to the option, you can disable it. I don't know what the limitations on that on. Maybe some people are opting in permanently, but anyway, I have the option turned on and off, and I know this because to test Hyperspace with both the non-file provider and non-file provider version, I have the non-file provider version on this Mac, and on the other Mac, I have the file provider version, so I can, you know, see the different behaviors. And it's the same account, and it's the same client software. So the idea is, don't use the file provider version, so then every file in your Dropbox is on your disk taking up space. There's no weird file stubs, there's no ubiquitous files, they're just plain, boring files that are just 100% there once they're synced, okay? But Backblaze will probably still skip them because they're in a folder called Dropbox and, you know, a well-known location. They'll just say, oh, well, I'm not going to check whether these are cloud-backed. I'm just going to say anything in a folder called Dropbox, anything under there we won't back up. Or whatever heuristics they use to figure out, is this a Dropbox folder? Maybe there's even a way they can just look it up in Dropbox, prefs where your Dropbox folder is. They might still be skipped, right? So, and people complain about that. Like, look, Backblaze, don't skip it based on the path. I'm telling you, I'm not using the file provider version. Just back them up. It's pissing me off. So the solution, the suggestion, very much in the hyperspace style, is how about you do an APFS clone of the entire Dropbox tree, which will take up essentially zero extra space, not really zero because it's a tiny directory entry for every single file, right? So, but effectively zero space in the grand scheme of things. Do a complete clone of your Dropbox tree to a location that does not have Dropbox in the path. And then Backblaze will back that up because Backblaze has no idea where those files came from, but it also won't take up any additional space on your disk. The problem is doing a giant recursive clone of your Dropbox tree. A, it's the painting the Golden Gate Bridge thing where when you start that recursive clone, things could have changed by the time it finishes. So it's not really a point in time snapshot, although you could do it. You could do it from a time machine snapshot if you wanted. But B, that's time consuming. Like just creating that directory trees and all the directory entries and entering all the metadata and all that stuff, that is time consuming. And if you have like a terabyte of Dropbox stuff, just doing that operation on a periodic basis, like, and what tool you, if you use rsync, rsync won't copy all the metadata. If you use rclone, you might get more data. If you use Apple's like Ditto tool, you'll get even more. Like you're starting to become like, you're starting to deal with like file system APIs and stuff that you don't want to deal with because like faithfully reproducing every aspect of files is difficult. And setting aside that Backblaze doesn't even back up all that metadata anyway, metadata on macOS is terrifyingly complicated these days, as I've had to find out with hyperspace. And so doing something as simple as, oh, I'm just going to make a copy of the directory. I'm sure, you know, it will take up effectively zero space, but will the metadata in every one of those files be identical to the source files? No, it absolutely won't. It'll differ in ways that probably don't matter, but it will differ. And so there's, now you have that in the mix. So it's another complication, but I just want to throw that out there. If you do this, you have to have the non-file provider version and you have to find some way to carefully and efficiently periodically make a full APFS clone. And by the way, don't just make a plain copy. You got to make sure those copies are clones, which they probably will be, but depending on the tool you use, they might not be. And anyway, point Backblaze is that, you know, Backblaze will back up that directory because it's not excluded because it has no idea this came from Dropbox. So that is the zero cost as long as your time has no value solution to this problem.
There are also some not free solutions to the problem. This is software. First is Arc, ARQ. Is it Marco that's used this? I feel like one of you's used
it. Yeah, I used it a long time. Years ago, I used it.
Do you have anything you'd like to add about that or just going to...
No, I mean, it's been a long time, so anything I say would be very outdated.
Okay.
This is, I think, just an independent developer making a piece of software that backs up files. And the person obviously has a passion for it and has developed this program over years. And it tries to be very careful and reliable. It is not big corporate bloatware, but it is also very clearly an idiosyncratic indie-style app that does one very specific thing. And a lot of people like it and have success with it. And it doesn't have the same limitations. Now, how does it handle the difficulties that I just described with Dropbox? I don't know. One thing I can imagine is that if you have the non-file provider version, that it will just back them up because it's like, well, they're just plain files. I'm not going to exclude them based on the directory name containing Dropbox. It's not going to do any of that. So thumbs up for Arc in that respect. But if you're using the file provider version of OneDrive or, you know, the Dropbox or any of these other things that Backblaze is skipping, I'm not sure how Arc will handle that. You could ask the Arc developer, but that is a third-party alternative to a piece of software, like an app that you run that will periodically back stuff up that is entirely divorced from the Backblaze code base and technique.
Yeah, and to be clear, my limited, very limited understanding of this is that it's mostly a bring-your-own-backup-destination kind of thing where you use Arc to manage sending data somewhere else, but the somewhere else is also your problem. I also just realized as I'm loading arcbackup.com, again, ARQ, there's some quotes on here. Quote, I honestly love this app, quote, Marco Arment, which is funny.
Nice.
But anyways.
I did say that.
But the I think they do, it appears they do dabble in providing the destination as well. But I think the bread and butter of Arc, from my limited understanding, is you have a place like a Synology or is one of like Backblaze B2 or the AWS equivalent. What is that I'm thinking of? The drawing a blank.
S3.
Thank you. Something along those lines that you are using Arc to manage backing up and restoring from there.
Yeah, it's very funny. Like, you look on their page, like, here's the storage locations. Amazon Drive, AWS, B2, Dropbox, Filebase, Google Cloud, Google Drive, OneDrive, PolyCloud, SharePoint, SFTP, Wasabi, Attached Disk or Network Share, S3 compatible server. Like, it is back-end, not back-end agnostic, but it's pluggable back-end. So if you just want to copy things from one hard drive to another, Arc will do it. If you want to copy things from a hard drive to S3, Arc will do it. If you want to copy things from a hard drive to, you know, Wasabi, which is another, like, S3-type server, like, it, that's... that's what this app does. And so people like the flexibility of, like, I just want to copy things from A to B, and let me pick what A is, and let me pick what B is, and let me use an app that is, you know, seemingly been developed over many, many years by a development team or an individual that are really enthusiastic about this problem space. And so there you have it. Arc is comes up a lot in these discussions.
And then there's I don't remember if this is a newcomer, which is what I was about to say, or if it's just been purchased by another group. But the same folks that do Kaleidoscope, which is my diffing tool of choice, they now own or run or whatever Parachute Backup, which is, again, just software. But what this is about is specifically with regard to iCloud, so iCloud Photos and iCloud Drive. This is a way to slurp up the stuff that's in iCloud and put it somewhere else as a backup. So if your use is limited to iCloud stuff, you might want to check out Parachute as well. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, this is another one of the problems. And I talk about this a lot with my Photos Backup thing. You know, Apple's Photos app on the Mac has options in its settings that says, hey, do you want me to download what they call, like, download originals to this Mac, which is I'm going to get the original full resolution version of all your images and I will download them on this Mac. Or do you want me to, quote, optimize storage, which basically means some of these photos aren't going to be on your Mac. We'll put the thumbnails on your Mac or whatever so you can scroll through them. But, like, when you double click on one to see the big version, we might not have downloaded that. So we'll download it. And that's to save disk space, because if your photo library is a terabyte and you have a 500 gig laptop, how can you ever have your whole photo library in there? Well, if you do optimize storage, it will make it look like your whole photo library is on there. But obviously, there's a demon behind the scenes that is downloading and evicting the full resolution photos periodically. So what if you're trying to back up your Mac? You're like, oh, I'm backing up my Mac. So I have my Mac has my whole photo library on it, and I'm backing up my Mac. Therefore, I have a backup of my whole photo library. It's like, well, if you have optimized storage on in your iCloud photo library and you make a backup, you're not backing up your whole photo library. You're backing up whatever portion of your photo library is on your Mac at that moment. And so I always advocate having at least one Mac that you say download originals on, right? But what if you don't have any Mac that has enough space to download all your originals on because your photo library is huge or your Mac SSDs are small? Parachute, what it will do is it will essentially go through your photo library and say, is this photo on the Mac? If it is, I'll back it up. If it's not on the Mac, it will say, okay, photo thing, download it, wait for it to download, back it up, and then evict it again. That's my impression of what Parachute is doing for you. It will laboriously piecemeal download your whole photo library a few photos at a time so it can back them up to wherever you're backing them up to, and then it will chuck them back off again. And obviously, if your whole photo library is on your Mac, you could use Arc to back it up, or Parachute Backup will have less work to do. It's like, hey, look, all the files were there. I backed them all up. But it's trying to capture a niche, which is like, well, lots of things in the Apple ecosystem won't even bother backing up your photos library. It's like, hey, it's in the cloud, and the cloud is the backup. And that's something we should mention here. Like, people think, all my files are in Google Drive, so they're backed up. All my files are in Dropbox, so they're backed up. A backup is not the same as having your files on a server somewhere in the cloud. Having your files on a server somewhere in the cloud is great if your laptop falls into the ocean. But if you accidentally delete all your files, or accidentally delete a file and don't notice until it's 30 days later and it's been removed from the trash, that's where backups come in handy, because backup is not the main location where your file is. It's a second location that is not affected by changes to the origin. So if you have a backup of a file and you delete that file, you can get it from the backup. If you have your file in Google Drive and you delete it from Google Drive, you can't get it anymore because you deleted it. And again, setting aside, it'll be in the trash for 30 days, yada, yada. The whole point is, like, if it's really gone from where it was, it should still be in your backup. But if something is really gone from your photo library and you don't have any backups, it's really gone. So that's why apps like Parachute help for people who, you know, are paranoid about this type of thing. I mean, I'm paranoid about photos to the point where I have my photos library uploading to Google Photos. So my originals are also in Google Photos. And Google Photos, there's no connection to Apple Photos. Like, if Apple burns down and my whole iPhone photo library dies and I lose all my Time Machine backups and I lose all my M-Disc optical discs, and, you know, like, this, like, my my fifth level backup, it's like, in the end, Google Photos also has all the originals from my photo library, and it doesn't know they came from my photo library. It just knows it has a bunch of images in it. And so, yeah, the more diverse your backup environment can be, the more protected you are. And that's what apps like Parachute and Arc are there for. They're not made by Apple. They're not made by Backblaze. They're not made by Google. They're made by another company. And so you're trying to, like, to Marco's point earlier about security bugs and stuff like that, try to spread the risk around across multiple companies, multiple things. Some of them are you know, in your house. Some of them are offsite. Some of them are cloud. Some of them are big companies. Some of them are small companies. I know it seems to me often that the main job of me and my computer is to back up my computer. Like, it seems like, what does your computer do other than back itself up? But if you have digital data that you care about to the degree that I care about my photos, for example, it is a considerable amount of effort to make sure that that data is protected in some way. Or otherwise you're just rolling the dice and hoping disaster never strikes. And even I am not fully protected. I am absolutely sure there are many failure modes in which I will lose all my data. But I'm just trying to minimize them to the best of my ability. And diversity in your backup strategies is a great way to do that.
And also, before we leave this topic, I wanted to point out that Mike has been on a journey. Mike Hurley has been on a journey for the last several Connecteds. I think that's right. I forget exactly when it was. But he has gone on this journey of trying to figure out a backup solution for himself. And he even talked to me about it on Analog, or the most recent episode of Analog. So if you want to figure out how Mike is solving this problem, you can listen to those episodes as well. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Brian Ash writes, "Hey, John, what year or generation is your Honda? Any plans on when you'll replace it? If you don't have plans, but if you had to replace it, what would you get?" Brian, John does not believe in hypotheticals. I am right there with you with this question,
you
Brian.
You did a whole member special on this hypothetical. How are you saying I don't believe in it?
Well, you're going to poke a hole in it, I guarantee it. Anyway, I looked at Honda's website, writes Brian Ash, and unless I missed it, it looks like they don't offer anything with a manual anymore. Are you driving less now that you're independent and or because of what your kids are doing now?
All right, so let's take this one piece at a time here. What year generation is my Honda? It's 2014. So it's over a decade old now. It's hanging in there. Any plans on when you'll replace it? My current plan is to replace it when it dies. What does dies mean? Well, you know, at a certain point, cars get so old that repairing them is no longer worth money. I will say that I'm probably willing to put a surprising amount of money into this to keep it on the road, but at a certain point, you know, it becomes untenable, the car gets sold or whatever. So I'll tell you what that point is, but right now I have no plans to replace it because I like it and it fulfills my needs and it's paid for. So yeah, it's hanging in there. It's low mileage. It's very low mileage.
About how many miles are on it, just off the top of your head?
Less than 45, I think. 43? So 2014 car with 43,000 miles on it. So this is low mileage. Low mileage example, as they would say.
my what is it, a 2018? I'm pretty sure I had that right. My 2018 Golf R has like 33,000 miles on it. So similar situation. You know, when you don't drive, if you don't have a commute and you're not driving long distance to offset that commute on a regular basis, you know, for whatever reason, you end up putting not too many miles
on
your
car. For probably, I don't know, like almost a decade, like my last job that I had for like 12 or 13 years, I commuted to it, but the commute was not long. Like having a short commute, like my commute was like 3 miles or so or something like that. I mean, it took forever because of traffic, but you know, distance wise, it wasn't long. Time wise, it was very often long. And so even when I was commuting, I wasn't racking up the miles. I know some people commute, you know, 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 miles to their job, and that will really rack up the mileage. So that's another reason this is low mileage. And then obviously quitting my job and working from home has just reduced it further. If I did have to replace it, what would I get? It, like with big TVs, I'm always looking for what would I get. That's my main activity, right? And in the car space, did you find the member special that we did about that?
No, I'm looking as we speak. I haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, in the car space, it's tricky because I want my next car to be electric, but I don't like any of the electric cars that are available. Right? Like I like them, but like, you know, when I rank, I don't like any of them better than my current car. You know what I mean? Like they all have something that annoys me about them. Makes me think I'll just wait until they figure that out and fix it. And they just keep always messing up one. Even my beloved Lucid Air. Like I hate that interior. I don't like what they did with the controls. And I'm like, oh, they'll fix it with the next revision of the Air. It's like, no, we're never revising that car. All right. So I don't know. There are other cars that I like. I think the member special hypothetical was more like if you had to, like if your car broke, you know, you got totaled or whatever, and you had to get a new car, what would you get? This right now, the answer would be I would get a stick shift Honda Civic without a sunroof on it. Because my wife has that car with the sunroof, and I really like her car, except the stupid sunroof hits my head. So she insisted on the one with the sunroof, as I think we talked about before, because she wants the heated seats and all the blah, 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 and you can't get that car without a sunroof with the trim level she wants, and it's her car, and she's way shorter than me, so it's fine for her, and she likes it. She likes her car. I like her car, too. I just don't like the sunroof. I would get a stick shift Honda Civic without a sunroof. I like the current generation. It's a really nice car. I recommend it to anybody. It's excellent. Even the hybrid is excellent, which I wouldn't buy because it doesn't come with a stick shift, but the hybrid is also excellent in the current model year, current generation of Honda Civic. And then are you driving less now that you're independent? Yes, because I don't have to commute to work. So even though it was only 3 miles, it was 3 miles there and 3 miles back every single day, whereas now, you know, run errands a couple times a week, but it's not every single day. And because of what my kids are doing, it's probably more because of what my kids are doing, because my kids are doing is going to schools that are far away, and I'm driving back and forth to either pick them up or drop them off or bring them stuff or whatever. So my son was like 45 minutes to an hour away, depending on traffic, and my daughter is like an hour and a half to 2 hours away, and I've gone back and forth to both of those schools a lot. So what my kids are doing is actually driving up my mileage.
Fair enough. HP Neutral car shopping from the 14th of May, 2024. We will put a link in the show notes. Jason writes, Mac hardware represents just under 8% of Apple's revenue. It will probably be overtaken by AirPods soon. Woof. My question is this. Which Apple CEO will remove the Mac from their lineup? Will it be John Turner? I don't think I want to keep reading this. Even I don't want to keep reading
keep
this.
Keep reading. I think there's an easy answer to this one.
Will it be John Ternus? He could be CEO until 2040. Do we think the Mac will exist in hardware form then? Will it be the next CEO after Ternus? If the best-selling Mac of all time is basically an iPhone and a bigger chassis, why not sell Mac OS as an app for iPhone users and save on manufacturing costs?
Everybody wants everything to be in their iPhone. My whole computer could be in my iPhone. Then I would just connect my phone to a keyboard and a mouse and a big monitor, and it would become a Mac.
The files are in the computer.
You just described a Mac Mini with a screen on it.
Yeah, that's just a Mac. That
yeah,
point.
Exactly. So the easy answer to this, and the one that everybody says because it is the easy answer, is as long as the Mac is the platform you use to develop for all of Apple's other platforms, you can't get rid of the Mac. Because then there would be no apps for the phone, there would be no apps for the iPad, there would be no apps for Apple TV, there would be no apps for Vision Pro. Well, you know, anyway.
Wow.
Like, that's on Apple. Apple did make, you know, a way to develop iPad apps on the iPad, but it's extremely limited. But, like, they never went whole hog and said, here's Xcode for the iPad, here's Xcode for Vision Pro, here's Xcode for the phone, for crying out loud. Full-fledged, 100%, can do everything Xcode. Like, and Apple could have done that. There's nothing stopping them from porting Xcode to the iPad and getting rid of the Mac, and, you know, like that's, but until they do that, they literally can't get rid of the Mac. Now, setting that aside, say they decide to do that. The new CEO comes in and says, we want to get rid of the Mac, so of course we have to port Xcode to the iPad, and then we'll be done. I think, especially in the current age of excitement over AI LLM stuff, where is all that action happening on Apple's platforms? It's not happening on the phone. It's not happening on the iPad. It's not happening on the Vision Pro. It's happening on the Mac because the Mac is the more technically capable and more open platform. And whether Apple recognizes it or not, I would encourage them to recognize the openness and power of the Mac is what is allowing Apple to participate in this stuff at all. Because if Apple didn't have the Mac, nobody would be trying to do this stuff on the phone or on the iPad because they're just too closed and make it too difficult. Whereas you can let command line stuff run wild on your Mac and screw everything up, and that's what people are currently excited about and doing. And so I think Apple should not get rid of the Mac. I think Apple should not close down the Mac any further, and I think they won't. I don't think Ternus is going to do that. He seems like he's a big Mac guy, and he's a nerdy person, and those people tend to like it. So don't look at the percentage revenue. Look at how important this platform is to the company. It is immensely important and, like, necessary for the company to continue to exist now. And if Apple removes that necessity by allowing you to develop software for their other platforms not on the Mac, it would still be dumb because the openness of the Mac is super important to Apple being even in the conversation for future innovations like AI stuff.
Yeah, I would go a little further and, like, what... First of all, like, what is a Mac? It's a computer running Mac OS. And that has shifted a little bit over time and, you know, all the different form factors and technical implementation details of what exactly that means. But for the most part, it's, you know, in broad strokes, a Mac is a computer that runs Mac OS. If you have an iPhone and you can plug it into other hardware and it becomes a keyboard pointing device and a screen running Mac OS, that's a Mac. And, you know, maybe it's an iPhone when you remove it from all that stuff, but, like, the combination of all those things, that's a Mac.
And as we've discussed in the past, putting two OSs on the SSD on the iPhone and having to deal with this, but, like, it's a probably a bad compromised Mac and a bad compromised phone. Yeah. But if it is truly a Mac, it will be running macOS, and you don't want your phone to be running macOS, so it's also got to be running iOS, and now you got a device that's running two OSs and virtualization and blah, 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 and there's so many compromises that have to do with that, which is why Apple has never actually shipped that product. Could you do it? Absolutely, 100%. You could do it. But I don't think anyone would want that product. It's just easier to make phones and Macs separately, and so Apple does.
Yeah, and as for, like, you know, the software differences between them, I don't think it's possible to open up enough pathways in the iOS software architecture for apps to make it able to do the kinds of apps people love the Mac for. People love the Mac. You know, software development is a big one. But what is it about software development that makes people want to and be able to do it on a Mac and either not want to or literally not be able to do it on iOS? It's a bunch of characteristics of what tool software developers use. Part of it is, yeah, command line stuff is often involved, or scripting. A lot of it is multiple applications operating on the same data, different tools integrating with other tools, and lots of different things, fast switching, multitasking. Like, a lot of that stuff either is impossible on iOS or is just such a pain in the butt that nobody wants to do it when a Mac is available. And to actually change that about iOS, you're just making a Mac at that. Like,
the way they would do that on iOS, like, it's totally technically possible. You know how? You run a virtual machine that essentially has macOS inside it, and everything that runs in that environment is running in a big shared Mac inside your phone. But, like, you can't break the sandboxing and security of the iPhone, because, like, why would you? You destroy the security model of the iPhone. But hey, I want to do all this stuff where everybody can see everybody else's data. I want to run full-fledged Xcode. No problem. We'll run you in a little VM inside the phone. Now you've got a little tiny world that's kind of like a Mac inside there where everything can see each other and you can run command line stuff. It's like the Linux virtual environment in Windows or whatever. Totally technically possible by essentially creating a new separate little world inside your phone where that stuff is allowed to happen. So even though you have technically modified iOS to do all the stuff that Xcode needs to do, you've done it by eventually boring a little hole in iOS and saying, here's this little playpen where Xcode gets to live. And it's essentially a environment that's more like the Mac inside the iPhone environment.
Yeah, and it isn't just software development that works this way. There's lots of tools and applications and needs that people have on computers that just don't fit well with the iOS, like, super isolated software model. And I don't think iOS will ever get there, because that's not what makes iOS good. Like, if anything, what we've seen, in recent years with trying to make the iPad more Mac-like in some of its windowing and multitasking features, what we've seen is that it often is kind of a sidestep, and a lot of iPad users actually don't like it and want to disable it or switch it back because it's a little clunkier or it's a little bit different, and it's kind of a mixed bag. It's very difficult to advance iOS, especially, like, once you're at the iPad scale, you're trying to make it closer to Mac. It's very hard to advance iOS towards the Mac in a way that doesn't make it worse at being what people loved about iOS before, or what has worked very well for iOS before. So I think the whole idea of iPhones and iPads replacing Macs, that idea is probably not going to happen. You know, what happens in computing, usually when we have a new platform come out, usually, or a new form factor, usually it doesn't replace anything. It just adds. People might choose to have multiple ones, or, you know, like when the watch came out, the watch didn't replace the phone. Some people said it would. It didn't. It hasn't, and it won't. And I don't think it's an inevitability that our phones or iPads are going to replace Macs or PCs. I think what we've seen in the computing industry is that there are certain form factors and ways of interacting and ways that the devices work that just hit a real sweet spot for people, and they tend to last, even though all the people who love talking about tech in the future are saying, oh, this thing's going to die. Like, certain things never die. I think the most obvious thing in what we know today that probably has the longest lifespan is the smartphone. The phone is just so ideal for people in so many ways, in so many like basic physical ways. The phone is great and very compelling and such a great balance of lots of things. I think the phone is going to be with us for the rest of our lives and probably significantly after that. And not just existing, I think being like the central computing device for most people, I think it's the phone for a long time. But also, I think the computer, the way we know it as like the Mac and Windows PC today, like that style of computer, I think is another one of those sweet spots. People have tried over the years to replace it and to make it obsolete and or to phase it out, and doesn't work because people love it and it keeps working really well, and lots of other things. Like, and look, you can, part of what you can say against the Tim Cook era at Apple is that Tim Cook clearly had the idea, for whatever reason, that the iPad was going to replace the Mac, and that you know, the iPad was the modern platform and the Mac was the legacy platform. And eventually he seems to have changed his mind on that. But for the first, I don't know, five to 10 years maybe of his leadership at Apple, that seemed like that was the plan. And customers didn't go for it. The iPad was not the future of all computing. It was the future of the iPad. And it has a market, it has uses, but it didn't replace the Mac or the PC for that many people. And Apple sure did try. They tried really hard to make to push it that direction, and it just didn't go that way. I think people have shown over and over again they love their phones and they love their laptops. And they don't necessarily want those things to merge, and no one's asking for those things to merge. And finally, one other thing to consider is that the computing industry for a long time has kind of been it keeps pushing this command and this assumption and this goal of like computers are too hard to use. We need to make computers easier for everyone, everyone else, all the non-nerds, easier to use. And there's a lot of truth in that. There's also a lot of like kind of, you know, false like advocating for groups that don't exist anymore or that exist a lot smaller than you think, or speaking for people or making decisions for like theoretical people that you're not really talking to real people. And I think what's also happening is all the people who don't know how to use computers are aging out. And most people today are fine operating a computer to the degree they need to operate it. And so the whole push of like, let's get rid of the Mac, it's too complicated, we're going to make everything simple, I think not only has that failed over the years, and not only is iOS getting more and more complicated over the years to basically match the complexity of a Mac or PC in many ways, but also the demand for that, the need for that is just a lot lower than it used to be, because way more people have basic proficiency at using computers now.
I don't think that's why the demand has gotten lower. I think the demand has gotten lower because Macs have actually gotten less intimidating. Like the Apple has done a lot of work on the Mac over many, many years to take those things that were the most difficult and confusing and make them less so. There's still a gap, obviously. A Mac is easier to screw up than a phone by a million miles or whatever, but compare how difficult it is to wrangle a Mac today. Like, compare, like, a MacBook Neo to, like, a PowerBook running classic Mac OS. Night and day level of expertise required. So I think people haven't changed. I think Apple has successfully, over many decades, made the Mac easier to use. Not as easy as an iPad, not as easy as an iPhone, but, like, to your point, I think they're reaching a point where they're getting to a threshold where it's, like, you can no longer argue for the elimination of this platform due to its intractable difficulty. Because now we've made it reliable and easy enough that to the average person it is not impossibly difficult. And that wasn't true in the early days of the PC was essentially impossibly difficult for way too many people if you weren't a computer nerd. Today, you don't have to be a computer nerd. You can throw a MacBook Neo at anybody. It's more complicated than a phone. It's more complicated than an iPad. They can screw it up more easily, but they will be successful in using it to a degree that you could not say for a Mac or any PC 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, but I think both things have happened. Like, the Mac is easier to use today, but also people, like, way more of the population is proficient at using Mac and PC style computers today as they used to be. But and also
proficient? No, they can, I think you're right, in your case you said they can do what they need to do with them. But it's the joke about Gen X being the only generation that knows how to use computers, because we had to help our parents with it when we were kids, and now I have to help my kids with it when I'm an old person.
Yeah, but proficiency, you know, like, does not mean power user. It means you're able to use the computer to do what
you need
to do with it.
I know, but even that, like, still, it's like, I can't print. I mean, the eternal one. Why can't I? Printing is not a power user feature. It's a thing that you have to do every once in a while. Why can't I print? My kids can't figure out why they can't print. My parents can't figure out why they can't print. I can figure out why we can't print. And my son now has a computer science degree. So, like, what's his excuse?
Right. Well, but also, and keep in mind also, like, having the smartphone take over the world has also affected this greatly. So, like, first of all, way more people are able to use smartphones because they are simpler in a lot of ways. And so many people's needs are perfectly satisfied with their smartphones.
They don't even have a Mac or a PC because they don't need one.
Right. Like, many people who don't want a computer or can't use a computer get their needs solved with a phone just fine.
Because having it, and to further that point, having a personal computer or a Mac is not a requirement to live in today's society. Having a smartphone essentially is.
And that also, like, I feel like, you know, many people who never learned how to use Mac and PC computers, they didn't need to. Like, they weren't really ever forced to. Whereas today, phones are pretty important for lots of society. And also, because people tend to like them more than they used to like old computers, people who are not into computers are more motivated to use their phones more often, and therefore actually become more proficient just by experience with them. Whereas that motivation, like, wasn't there for them for a computer necessarily. So the need to wedge all this simplicity into Mac OS and ruin what the Mac is, or get rid of the Mac over time, that need is gone. Meanwhile, the MacBook Neo just came out. It's a Mac for the price of an iPad, and everyone is loving this. People are so much more excited about the MacBook Neo than I have heard about any iPad model released in probably the last 8 years. Like, I can't imagine. I can't remember the last time anybody was this excited about an iPad. The MacBook Neo is a hit. Why? Because people who want an iPad, mostly that's, like, you know, more basic needs, like watching TV and stuff like that, and that need's been solved for a long time by the iPad. That's nothing new. But people love having the Mac in a lower price point. And it doesn't need to be a super powerful MacBook Pro. It wasn't about computing power. And that's how we know. Like, you take an iPhone chip and you put it in a Mac, and you have, you know, a pretty limited Mac in terms of, like, sheer hardware capability. But people love working that way. They love using a computer like that. That, I think, the great reception of the MacBook Neo, I think, proves this point, that what people have wanted all this time, that Apple was trying to make the iPad the future of computing. What most people want for their computing is a computer. And what most people like about the Mac is not replaced by an iPad with a keyboard that ends up costing $1,300, you know, for the combo or whatever. Like, people like a Mac. And making just a cheaper Mac with lower hardware specs, people love that. And, you know, meanwhile, the idea of making the iPad the future of computing, it seems like that is increasingly not the case. The iPad is another platform that many people use and love, but it is not going to replace the Mac.
All right. And then finally, Paul Franz writes, a recent macOS bug report suggests that macOS will crash after reaching 49 days of uptime. John Gruber, in his article about it, says that 91 days of uptime is remarkable. Both of these numbers seem really small to me. I run Linux at work. Some new desktop software has been causing me problems, and our desktop support team pointed out my uptime was over a month and could use a reboot. Is my experience with Linux servers giving me unreasonable expectations for desktops? Unless I'm out of the loop, I don't hear this brought up with other devices running a Linux or macOS kernel, like phones, watches, TV, or cars. To be fair, I looked at my macOS uptime going back to November on my laptop, and the longest uptime was 40 days. My Linux server's longest uptime was 7 months. Its WTemp goes back to 2022. I believe in all these cases there were OS updates or needing to physically move my server. Rebooting for updates seems less annoying than things breaking and requiring an immediate restart.
Yes, I don't think the expectations are out of whack, but as was kind of alluded to here, if you don't shut down your Mac every day like Jason Snell because you're a weirdo, if you have a Mac and you're conscientious, as Marco suggested at the beginning of the show, your uptime is going to be determined by Apple's OS release cycle, because you have to reboot when they update, when they do a point release. So 15.7.7 comes out, you do the update, you reboot. That is, for me, for someone who leaves my Mac on all the time, and I just put it to sleep when I'm not using it, and then I wake it up when I'm using it, but I never, ever, ever shut down. My uptime is 100% determined by when Apple releases software updates. I tend not to do a software update right before I record a podcast, so maybe it'll be delayed by a couple days, but that's it. But if I didn't do that, how long would my uptime be? I mean, essentially forever. Like, I have had kernel panics on this Mac at various times, especially with all my video card swapping and stuff, but it doesn't happen very frequently, so I'm sure I could have had, like, multiple years where I just had an uptime of multiple years. Here's the other problem. You reboot for all sorts of reasons. When I go on a long vacation, I like to shut down and unplug my computer. When I reboot into Windows, there goes my uptime. But, like, theoretically, if you have a stable system running Mac OS X or Mac OS or whatever, there's no reason why you should ever need to reboot it short of software bugs. And software bugs requiring a reboot are very rare. Even bugs that require, like, everything is frozen and dead, if you just kill login window for SSH in and kill login window, your uptime will be maintained, even though you just booted yourself back to the login screen. But that doesn't affect your uptime because, hey, the machine is still up. So now, obviously, Linux servers that are just doing one thing over and over again and don't have any software updates that are running on them, although I think that is also rare, and it should be rare because you should be patching your you should be updating, to get into Marco's point, you should update everything, even your servers, every once in a while. But in theory, people have these Linux servers, they never update them, they run the same software year after, like, the only thing that's going to take them down is a hardware problem or whatever. And I think that is also true of any modern device, like an Apple TV or a phone or a Mac or whatever. But the world we live in is a world where there are software updates, and you should apply them a lot of the times, because a lot of the times they are security related, and also software does have bugs. So, yeah, I don't think it's that. If someone just says, hey, your Mac has been up for a long time and you should reboot, that's maybe not great advice. But the one of the things that I tell my kids every time they tell me their computer is doing something flaky, like, you know, it's the whole turn off and turn on again. Rebooting is one of the first, best, easiest diagnostic steps. Did you have to reboot? It's like, no, but, like, it takes 2 seconds. Macs boot really fast these days, and if it solves the problem, like, then try that first before you come to me. Like, X isn't working, Y isn't working, and very often it's like some app isn't working. It's like, I don't know, log out and back in, which is the soft version of a reboot, which is like, maybe that app has a bug and it's screwed up in some way, and if you log out and back in, it will fix it. But if nothing fixes it, you can reboot. But if there's nothing wrong with your computer and you're like, oh, you have uptime of a month, you should just reboot just to be safe. No, if it's working fine, you don't need to reboot.
Good deal. I remember when I was first on my own, I ran some flavor of, I want to say Ubuntu, on like a ThinkPad or something like that. This was 20 years ago, so I can barely remember now. But I remember being very impressed by the uptime of that machine. And I remember being so impressed by it that when I at one point needed to either shut it down or reboot it or whatever the case may be, I actually captured a PDF of a little like diagnostic page that I'd written. And the record server uptime, which was recorded actually a month after me being married to Aaron, so this was 2007, excuse me, server uptime 299 days, 6 hours, 28 minutes. And I was very proud of that at the time.
Yeah, if you search the internet, you'll find people with, like, this Linux server has been running for 37 years. Like, yeah. Not joking, 37 years, like, literally, well, I don't know if that fits with Linux, but there are Unix servers. There are, like, I'm sure there are some of those, like, you know, very fancy mainframes with redundant CPU and power supplies that are doing, like, Visa transactions for all of our lives, like, that's a little bit fudge where it's like, well, it has the same thing been up because they've swapped out the CPU a few times. But anyway, yeah, there are lots of long-running things out there. And Linux is one of the first ones you started to see people brag about, because, like, regular tech nerds would just, like, set up a Linux server in their house somewhere, and then they'd wake up 25 years later and they'd realize they'd never rebooted it, and they'd post a cool screenshot or whatever. But, yeah, as with all things, again, I always find it hilarious when people post screenshots as proof of anything. It's like, you know, you can make any pixel in any arrangement in a bitmap. You know, you can just like I can turn on and off any pixel, and I can make any pixel any color. Screenshots are not proof of anything. But yeah, you can just edit WTEP directly and then type uptime and be like, wow, uptime of 5 millennia. But no, I'm assuming people are being honest because, computer systems can be made reliable in the right circumstances.
Who knew?
All right, is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right, let me pull up the overtime thing real quick. Ah, it just moved. Ah.
I know, I collapsed the thing. I wish it would preserve your scroll position even if I collapse the stuff. I wish it would, like, pull down the top, but, you know.
All right, thanks to our sponsors this episode, Aura Frames and Delete Me. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime. This is our weekly bonus topic. Every single episode, there is more content that non-members... Sorry, you're missing out. Members, you get it. It's great. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about, basically, should Apple make Neo versions of more products, more affordable iPhones, Macs, etc. We're going to talk about that in overtime this week. You can join to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. What are we doing for post-show?
John, you had something, right?
It's the boring file system thing. If that's all we've got, that's all we've got.
I mean, this is a good episode for that.
Yeah, that I suppose. Is true. Although this thing has been here so long, I need to order the links and remind myself what the hell I'm talking about.
Did a Mythos pre-show. Actually, you know what? Before we move on to your real post-show, I did want to call out the update to Pedometer +++. This is our friend David Smith, _David Smith's app, Pedometer +++. I've mentioned a little bit here and there as I prepare for my giant walk around Manhattan, which is actually this weekend, my big 32-mile walk. It's in a couple of days. I've been testing out, like, you know, different watch options for that, the app I've been using on the Apple Watch Ultra has been the beta of Pedometer +++ 8. And that just came out, I think, you know, yesterday, the day before. It's brand new, and _ has a couple of great blog posts about it. Our friend Stephen Hackett over at 512 Pixels also did a great post about it. It is such an amazing app, because what I love about Pedometer +++ is, and I made a little Mastodon post about it earlier, but I'll repeat myself here. In the App Store, you know, in the kind of Apple developer ecosystem, sometimes you get an app that somebody has just poured so much love into, even if there might not necessarily be, like, an ROI that justifies that level of investment. This is something that, like, this has exemplified, like, this is what people love about the Apple indie developer scene. This is what made a lot of us fall in love with the Mac, and certainly the software scene around it. That, you know, just people who put in a huge amount of care, and whether that's design, engineering, polish, you know, some combination of all three, like a huge amount of care going into a fairly specialized app. More care than that app necessarily, like, quote, needs in terms of, like, what would the market pay for or support or whatever, but mostly because that person or company just cares so much about making something great in that area. Usually it's like it's something they personally love and they just want it to be great.
You want to hear the great phrase from the gaming industry for the phenomenon you're describing? It's called over-delivery.
I like that.
It's said in a pejorative way in various contexts, but yeah, over-delivery. You are delivering too much.
Right, and we hear, you know, I think another term for this is a labor of love, which is also sometimes used pejoratively. But I think there is a lot of truth to that. Like there are certain apps that you look at and you're like, oh, this was a labor of love. And I personally take that as a compliment when somebody calls something that I made, you know, something like that. Because that like the way to use it pejoratively is like, wow, this idiot wasted their time doing this thing that's not worth it. But the way I see it is much more generous. It's more like, wow, like this person put so much love into a thing, not because they needed to, but because they wanted to. And that's, you know, as long as, you know, the bills are getting paid, it's fine, right? And so Pedometer +++, you know, _ makes Widget Smith. And by all accounts, Widget Smith is so ridiculously popular that, like, I think numbers-wise, he probably shouldn't spend any time ever working on anything else. Like, if you just calculate, like, you know, where does it make sense to devote your time? Like, you have this one massive mega hit product. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, like Tim Cook wasn't having like a side gig, you know, making making little apps for himself. Like he had enough to deal with, you know. And, you know, so _ doesn't need to make Pedometer +++. He makes it because he loves it and he makes it for himself. And this update to this app, like, you think it's just a step counter, and it is a pretty good step counter, but then behind the step counter is this, like, world-class hiking and walking tracker, especially in the Apple Watch. Like, if you are walking or hiking, and it actually supports other types too, but I think those are the big ones. Walking, hiking, anything where you could use a map on your wrist, or distance measurements on your wrist, or step counts, or whatever. It actually probably would be good for cycling too. But anyway, if you are doing, like, you know, walking, hiking, running, cycling, things where you are outside following trails or maps or whatever, the experience of using Pedometer Plus Plus on the watch, it was always good, but now it is even better. He brought in a designer to help him make these amazing... He brought in a cartographer to help him make the maps look better. How many people do you know who have hired a cartographer for anything? He brought in a cartographer. He brought in a designer. It looks incredible. It works great. The engineering behind it is great. It destroys the, like, you know, in terms of, like, how nice it looks, it destroys all the other fitness watches and Apple's built-in apps and any other app I've ever seen, third-party or first-party, in terms of niceness of this experience. One of my favorite things, too, is that it has this this expedition mode where, to extend the Apple Watch battery life, there's a few tricks you can do, but if you want your Apple Watch to last, like, multiple days of a hike, you can turn on expedition mode, and that's a special workout mode that doesn't use the heart rate at all. Like, if you're just walking, if you're hiking, the heart rate might not be that relevant to you. So you can turn off the heart rate and get 40% more battery life, which is massive. So all this is to say, like, this is an amount of coolness and niceness and effort into an app that this one guy has, I think, embarrassed the rest of the industry with how good his app is for these purposes compared to the built-in Apple Workouts app, the Suunto, the Garmin's, like, all those watches of the world. Like, this app is awesome. So if you go outside and walk or run or bike or hike, which is just walking, I think, but in the woods or something, like, if you do those things, check out Pedometer Plus Plus, especially on the watch, where it really shines. It's a great phone app as well, but the watch, and, like, no one else is doing Apple Watch development worth a damn except Underscore. Like, he blows everyone else away in terms of, like, how much effort he puts into the Apple Watch as a platform, because the platform fights you at every turn. It's very developer hostile for lots of good reasons and some bad reasons. And he gets through it, and he does great work on the watch. And so it has made me, like, re-fall in love with the Apple Watch as a fitness device for that particular purpose, for the walks. And even though I also like the Suunto for other reasons, Pedometer Plus Plus is so good. So check it out.
Yeah, when we went on spring break a couple of weeks back or a month back, we did some hikes, including one that was, I think I described it on the show, 2 miles out, 2 miles back. And what I did was I found on, like, All Trails or something like that, I found a GPX, which is, you know, a series mm-hmm. of waypoints. I think it's XML, but it doesn't really matter.
It is. File. It's really ugly.
Yeah, there you go. I found that and sent it to Pedometer Plus Plus, and then it would show me, am I on or off the track that was provided via the website, the All Trails website, which was really, really slick. It's really good stuff. And that was the old version. That was version 7 or whatever of Pedometer Plus Plus. This is really good stuff. Underscore's put in an astonishing amount of engineering work. And, like Marco said, I mean, who says I hired a cartographer? How do you even do that?
Do you go on LinkedIn? Like, what?
Right. Like, how do you find your friendly neighborhood cartographer? I mean, just ridiculous. This is
next to the cobbler.
Right. I've said many times throughout the course of the show. One of the main reasons I think that we are successful, the three of us, at doing this show is really two, actually. Number one, you know, I think the three of us have a pretty good chemistry, and even though sometimes we want to murder each other, by and large, we're really dear, close friends, and I think that comes through in shows. But number two, and what's relevant here, is that we really and truly give a crap. We don't always succeed and execute perfectly, but we really and truly give a crap. And that is something that is extremely true of Underscore broadly and of Pedometer Plus Plus specifically. And like Marco said, I mean, I don't know anything about Underscore's, you know, business finances or anything like that, but I have to assume that just an astonishing, overwhelming share of the money that his business earns is from Widgetsmith, which he also gives a crap about. But nevertheless, because this is a labor of love, complimentary, because this is something that is scratching an itch that Underscore very much has, he still spends a lot of time on Pedometer Plus+, and it shows. And I haven't had yet had the chance to read. He also put up a blog post about how he spent, this is literally the title of his blog post, 6 years perfecting maps on watchOS. And that's both a testament to Underscore's tenacity and perseverance, and also how shitty watchOS development is.
Oh my God, it's so bad.
Anyway, you get the point. So yeah, you should check it out. It's good stuff.
I have one more unrelated tidbit on this. Back in the classic macOS days, when it was the Wild West and there was no memory protection and there was cool little system extensions to change the way everything looked in the operating system, there were various engines that could do cool things like make it look like your windows are transparent. It's, you know, something that is trivial now. Everything has it. But before the age of compositing window managers, when your app drew a window, it didn't know what was, the system when you're dragging a window around didn't know what was behind it. It was just, like, telling the things to draw the new dirty areas of the screen. There was no compositing window manager, which meant that, like, in a compositing window manager, some part of the operating system says, okay, give me all your windows. You want a white window here. You want a yellow window here. You want this window here. And by the way, the windows can also have transparency values. Like, I got all the windows. I know where they all are. You've told me what's in the bitmaps for them. And you've also told me for every single pixel how transparent it should be. Now I will combine all those windows into a final image that you will see on the screen by compositing them together. I'll take the back thing, and then I'll put the next layer over it. Then I'll put the next layer. Then I'll put the next layer. And as I'm layering them on, hey, if I'm layering a window on top of some other stuff, and that window has some pixels that have some transparency, I will blend them with the stuff that I know is behind them. That's what a compositing window manager does. That was introduced with Mac OS 10. Before that, that was not how it worked. Before that, applications drew directly into like a backing buffer for the entire screen, and they just drew opaque pixels. But if you were clever, you could say, hey, I'm about to draw my window onto the screen, and there is stuff already on the screen. So before I draw what's on the screen, I'll look to see what's in the area that I'm about to draw the window, and I will blend those pixels with my pixels in a transparent kind of way. And so what they were doing is drawing an opaque window that contains contents that look like it's showing what's behind it. Now, the tricky part of that is if you then move something, if something behind it changed, your app had no idea that it happened. You know, it's not like macOS 10 where the operating system would be like, I'm constantly, every frame I'm compositing. This would be like, well, when I drew this window, like if you had like a clock behind you, when I drew this window, here's what was behind me. But then a second passes and the clock ticks over and your window has no idea that that happened because it has no awareness of what's going on behind it, right? So what I'm saying is you could get fake transparency, which only became apparent when like you either move something in the background or something changed in the background. And you're like, oh, I see. You're not really compositing. And like you could fudge it by saying, okay, every few seconds, you know, look at what's behind you and then redraw it yourself. And every window could do that, like that fake transparency. Here's why this is relevant to your Underscore discussion. I feel like Casey with this long way to
all right. Relax.
And speaking of like, you know, Underscore cares about this app and everything, and Casey said, and Widgetsmith too, he cares about. I recall seeing a thread go by, I think on Mastodon, where Underscore was describing what he wanted to do was make essentially transparent widgets, but there is no good way to do that. So he's like, well, if I just know what's behind them and I draw them exactly how they would be appear if they were transparent, they'll look transparent. But, oh, to do that, I have to know down to the, not just down to the pixel, but down to the, like, the, you know, the, yeah, down to the screen pixel, not just the point, but down to the screen pixel where everything is on the screen. Because I have to draw my widgets as if you can see through them. So I need to know where every single other element is on the screen so the illusion is perfect. But, oh, there are so many different sizes of iPhones. And also, by the way, people can have that magnifying mode on the iPhone. So he wrote this program, I forget if it was Vibe Coded or not, that would automate the process of figuring out every single Apple device, every possible set of display settings, every possible widget arrangement on every possible screen. So he would know, so he could exactly fake with Widgetsmith widgets that appeared in a way that seemed impossible because he's faking it down to the pixel for any iPhone and any display resolution and any zoom factor. And like, he cares a lot about everything he does, not just Phenomena Plus Plus. And that's for a feature, which I think, by the way, is stupid. But he didn't think it was stupid. He thought it was cool. And so he went like, talk about going the extra mile. It's like anybody would have looked at that and said, yeah, you can do it. But I mean, it would be ridiculous. And Underscore was like, but you can do it, right? And he did it. I believe this is shipping. So all this is to say that Underscore doesn't just care about Widgetsmith. He cares about, or doesn't just care about Panorama Plus Plus. He cares about Widgetsmith and all his other apps as well. So check him out.
I think that's our post show.
Yeah, that's pretty good, actually.
We can save my boring topic for another time.
Okay. All right, titles.
All right. Where is the right tab?
I like our vigilance was thwarted. And
Audion was cool,
effect,
by the way. Panic's Audion did that fake transparency, and they tried to do the best possible job, but you could still tell it wasn't, you know, there's no compositing window manager on classic Mac OS, but boy, did we all give it the old college try.
I really like the top one, the positive effect of enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
I do also like our vigilance was thwarted, but I think the positive
one. Yeah, the enthusiasm is the clear winner. Not a lot of titles today, though.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Okie dokie, give me
a... Are we going against a baseball game or something?
Not this time, I don't think. Well, we're always
going
against...
We're always
going
to like the World Series or
the
State of the Union.
We're always against a baseball game. It's just I don't think it's a significant baseball game.
That's true.
All right, give me 1 second to put all this in the robot. You can vamp for just a moment.
All right, well, anyway, thank you, live people, for coming around tonight. This was fun.
Oh, wait, next week is Thursday.
Yes, next week. That's my fault. School ruins everything.
Truth.
Yes.
It's a band concert, right?
Yes, but it's a school band concert.
All right. Yeah.
It's not like a Fish concert or anything. next week, band concert. So my fault. We're moving to Thursday. So anyway, talk to you on Thursday, everybody. Thank you.